Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
What a good audience. Good afternoon. I'm John Cook with the Library Foundation. And you're at one of our special Allowed events. The Foundation and the Los Angeles Public Library, as you know, put these events on. This is a very special one, and we're pleased that you could be here. I want to welcome you to a conversation between Tom Brokaw and Geneva Overhost. After their conversation, I would hope that you will be aware that they will answer questions, but you can't ask your question until a microphone is in front of you because we're recording this, so you don't want to miss being recorded. I do want to introduce some very important people before I introduce our two participants today. I want to introduce the city librarian, Chris Morita. Would you please stand, Chris, and wave? And then I'd like to introduce the Board of Library Commissioners, and I'd like to introduce Tyree Weeder. Tyree, would you please? Rita Walters. And Marcia Hirano Nakanisha. Many of you know that last night we gave the literary award to Tom Brokaw, and we're so pleased that he offered to participate today. And it's very much a pleasure for me to introduce the moderator today. Geneva Overhoster is an award-winning journalist, educator, and scholar. And she happens to currently be the director of the School of Journalism at the USC Annenberg School. Now I have to confess, I have a point of view about this. I am the chairman of the Board of Counselors at the Annenberg School, so I can speak personally about her talent and her skill and her wisdom. You should know that Geneva served for many years as editor of the Des Moines Register, where she led the paper to a Pulitzer Prize for public service. Her previous titles included Ombudsman of the Washington Post, the Editorial Board of the New York Times, and a columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. And also, once upon a time, she was a reporter at the Colorado Springs Sun. In 2006, through the Annenberg Public Policy Center, she published a manifesto on the future of journalism entitled On Behalf of Journalism, A Manifesto for Change. And as we all know, change is truly coming to journalism. Well, as I talk about Tom Brokaw, all of you I know will be thinking, I know. That's what happens when you have a trusted and respected figure in broadcast journalism who has been in our living rooms, our dens, our kitchens for numerous years. Now in our presence, we think, oh, this is our good friend. And actually, we've convinced ourselves that he knows us. After all, 21 years of having dinner with Tom, we are close friends. He came to us from KMTV in Omaha, WSB-TV in Atlanta, and yes, KNBC-TV in Los Angeles. And, of course, we all remember him as the host of the Today Show. And for 21 years, anchor and managing editor of the NBC Nightly News. Now, on top of all that, he's a best-selling author. Of course, you know his book, The Greatest Generation, and he has written several other prize-winning books. He received, and I think it's important for us to note here, the prestigious Advancement of Literacy Award from the American Library Association in 2004, after he aired a full hour, Tom Brokaw's special report, on adult literacy, Dateline NBC. Please join me in welcoming Tom and Geneva.
Thank you so much, John, for that lovely introduction. I don't see how Los Angeles could possibly operate without John. He seems to chair every other board. Thank goodness for him. You all can imagine what a great delight it is for me to be here with you in this beautiful room and to have a conversation with the extraordinary Tom Brokaw. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this. Last night was a grand occasion. Tom was honored once again, and among the things you said last night, Tom, that I would like to refer back to, as a recent arrival in California, I find California so remarkably open, especially Los Angeles. And your version of, I think, that same sentiment was to say that when you moved here, you felt instantly that you'd found a place that was really a meritocracy. Tell more about what you were thinking about when you said that. I found it fascinating.
Well, I remember, as if it were yesterday, driving from Atlanta to Los Angeles to begin my career with NBC News. We had a newborn, and so Meredith had gone home to South Dakota with her, with Jennifer, and I was on my own. I had a lot of time to think about it. I was 26 years old and just a few years out of South Dakota, and wondering what it was going to be like to be in the big state of California and in Los Angeles with all of its dynamic qualities. And as I crossed the border, that was very much on my mind. And within a couple of weeks, it was clear to me that I had come to the truest land of opportunity I knew anywhere in the world. That when you come into California, as I said last night, no one is at the border checking your pedigree. They don't ask you where you went to school or when your family arrived in this country or what your family may have done earlier. They just want to know whether you can do the job, and they say, in effect, welcome. We're out here on the left coast of America, and we're making things happening, and we're reinventing America in new ways every day. And everybody is metaphorically invited to jump into the pool. There's a little story that I've told in the past in one of my books. When Meredith arrived about a month after I'd gotten here and gone to work, on our first Saturday night in town, we arranged for a babysitter, and we went down to Santa Monica to go to dinner. Meredith had never seen the Pacific Ocean at that point. And there was a place that some of you in this room may remember called Jack's at the Beach. It was a kind of a famous restaurant on the beach. And we were too young and too naive to know that we got the worst table in the restaurant. It was back by the swinging door to the kitchen. Right. But we had not seen each other in a month, and we were having a wonderfully romantic dinner, realizing, I think, fully for the first time how our lives had taken this very dramatic change, and our fortunes, which had always been pretty good up to that point, really had escalated in a way that we could not have anticipated. And after dinner, we walked down along the beach, and Meredith took off her shoes, and we were both had been both lifeguards and swimmers, and we loved the water, and she waded into the surf up to a point in this, I remember, in this kind of organza dress that she was wearing along the moonlight shoreline of Santa Monica. And I looked at my beautiful bride, and I thought, our lives have changed forever. This is a new life for us, and there are possibilities here that we could not have imagined just a year earlier. And that turned out to be true. California was, for us, a magic carpet ride. It It's a place that we hold very dear in our hearts. We say to each other very often, of all the stops that we've made, we're so glad that we came to California when we did. Two of our children were born here. The other one was raised here. One went to Stanford. One went to Berkeley at the same time. That was a little tricky. When I had one at Stanford, one at Berkeley, I made a speech at Berkeley in which I said it's like having one who's a member of the Grateful Dead, the other one who's a member of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. That went over very well at Berkeley. It was not so well received at Stanford. And now two of our children live in California. One lives in San Francisco, the Stanford child. Not a child anymore. She's a physician married to a doctor that she met at Dartmouth. And our youngest daughter, Sarah, who didn't go to school out here, went to Duke, but has lived here now. This is her second cycle through California, and she's very much a part of it.
Well, your fortunes were turning up, as you said, when you were here, although they had already been good, but boy, did they continue to. And your career, of course, invites such interesting retrospection. You've interviewed Gorbachev in the Kremlin and Reagan in the White House, and you were in Reykjavik. I was writing about Soviet-U.S. relations when you were covering these amazing things, and I'm envious, as everyone in the audience I know is, of your personal experience of these remarkable people and occasions. And I wonder if you could just share some highlights, some of the most stirring moments. I know you were at the Berlin Wall. We share a boss, Michael Gartner,
right,
who has bragged about getting out ahead of sending you, you know, to
right,
be there at the wall.
Came down, right.
Yeah, so talk about some of the most stirring moments of your
career. Well, to do it in a kind of an abbreviated form, I grew up in the Great Plains in South Dakota. My dad was a working class guy. He was an extraordinarily skilled heavy construction equipment operator, so he always had a good job, but we moved a lot. And my mother, who wanted to be a journalist, but because of the Depression couldn't go to college, was the assistant postmistress in the communities where we lived. And so she was the best managing editor I ever knew, because she knew everything that was going on in town, because it all came through the post office. I've often said to people that growing up in that part of the world, I think, helped shape me as a journalist, because there was not a lot going on around us. So you're always looking over the horizon. What else is going on out there? And we listened to the radio very carefully and read Life magazine and the Sunday Minneapolis Tribune in those days. And I had this enormous curiosity about the world and thought I would like to be a journalist, but I didn't quite know what that meant, because there were no models around me. And I was studying political science. And the 1960 election came along, and I had been working in radio and television stations already and writing for school newspapers. And I stayed up all night long and watched that back-and-forth race between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. And I was devoted to NBC in those days. And at the end of this marathon, at 8 o'clock in the morning, I went to bed with a small dim light saying, I think that's what I want to do with my life. I want to be a network correspondent, and I can get the network to pay for me to see the world. And then I realized later in life that I'd overwished on that count. You know. So in summary, I have been able to brush up against, and not just brush up against, but get to know on very familiar terms a lot of the shapers of our time and the events of our time. When people ask me about the most memorable people or events, I say there are two really overwhelming ones, and that was the hardest week I ever spent was the week of 9/11. We didn't know what was coming from where next. It was so unexpected. I do believe that when historians come to look at our time, that the collapse of the Soviet Union will be the signature event. A lot of us of our generation thought that communism would prevail into the 21st century, and it came down much more swiftly than that, and I got to know Gorbachev along the way. I think in this country, the biggest single story of my lifetime, and the one that is most welcome, was the power of Dr. King and his crusade of nonviolence to move the nation to throw off the yoke of segregation. I think we're a much different and much more liberated country now as a result of all that. It's sometimes when you're in the middle of what I sometimes describe as skiing in an avalanche, you don't take enough time to pause and look around and think about the consequences of all this. With Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, who were two of the larger-than-life figures that I had to deal with, they both had this kind of self-confidence that they knew what they believed and they wanted to see it acted out. And they were not looking over their shoulder every nanosecond wondering what the polls were saying, that they had a strong vision of where they wanted to get to. I began covering Reagan in 1966 here in California when he was running for the Republican nomination for governor, and a lot of people thought he was just an actor and he couldn't possibly make it. So I was on the bus with him a lot up and down the Central Valley and all over Los Angeles, and then I covered him all along the way, 2 terms as governor, 2 terms as president of the United States, the triumphs and the political falls that he had. And I asked for the last interview that he was going to give in the White House, and it was on the Friday before he was to leave, all carefully arranged, and it was kind of a tick-tock schedule. And the White House chief of staff said to me, but he has something he wants to add to the schedule once the interview is over. He wants to take you out into the Rose Garden on the portico overlooking it at the White House. And I said, fine. He said, we don't know what he has in mind. So I go out there with him. And Reagan was a very reserved man. A lot of people don't realize that. For all of his gregariousness and his public appearances, he had an enormous amount of reserve about him, and it was sometimes a little difficult to penetrate that very private Ronald Reagan. But he walked me out onto the portico, and he said, in that Ronald Reagan-like way, you know, Nancy and I were talking this morning, Tom, and we were remembering that you were there at the very beginning, in 1966, before I even got the nomination. I said, that's true, Mr. President, I was, and what a thrill it's been for me to be able to be a reporter during all of your ascendancy. And just then a photographer appeared, and that was the whole purpose of him taking me out there, to take pictures of us, and he put his arm around me, and he said with that Reagan twinkle in his eye, he said, you know, it worked out pretty well for both of us, didn't it?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you've talked about public personas. Let's talk about yours. John's quite right. When he introduced you, he said, you know, people think they know you. America thinks we know you. I was talking to one of my colleagues who said, well, he's just the best. You know, he's at once authoritative yet approachable. And somebody else said, yeah, sort of like the boy next door, if the boy next door were that handsome and spoke in such stentorian tones, right? But the truth is that over the years of your work, you have been both a journalist and have yet also become a celebrity, and the two must be somewhat awkward cohabitants. What is that like?
Well, I don't try to keep them in balance. I really try to emphasize the journalistic part of it, and I understand that the celebrity lowercase comes with the territory. You're on television, therefore people know who you are. One of the stories that I've told often that has always put that in perspective for me, when I was a junior in college, I was working in Sioux City, Iowa on a television station and commuting back and forth trying to pay my way to college to get my degree. And I could just make it to the end of the week with my salary. And on a Sunday morning, I was down in Sioux City, Iowa. You'll remember this, Gretchen, from your days in the Midwest. All those communities had big cafeterias in those days where you would go to get a meal at a good price. And I was standing outside this cafeteria looking at the menu, figuring out what kind of meal I could get for the $2.50 I had in my pocket, literally what I had in my pocket. 2 very well-dressed couples walked out, and they obviously had no trouble paying their bill. They were very prosperous, and they got so excited about seeing me because I was on television. And when they turned and walked away, I thought to myself, and it was very helpful for the rest of my life, that pretty much sums up the price of being a celebrity. I can't afford a meal, and they're very excited about seeing me.
Well, we hope you're doing a little better now on your dinner front.
Well, the other piece of it is I did grow up in this working class environment, and I came from the small towns of the Great Plains, and I married somebody who was so remarkable, it's hard for me to describe all of her qualities now, who always had a way of keeping me kind of in context without saying anything. And so, as I like to say, when I came home, people would say to me, well, you know, what is it like for your family? The two of you grew up in a small town in South Dakota, and suddenly you're the anchor of NBC Nightly News. You're known everywhere. And I said, be perfectly honest about it. When I get home at night and Meredith remembers what it is that I do for a living, I'm thrilled because it's not a big part of her life. And I think that's been very helpful to me.
Well, are there going to be anchors? I mean, you talked last night about what's happening to news. I, as a newspaper person, of course, worry every day about how long newspapers are going to survive. How long is the evening news going to survive?
Well, I watched those numbers very carefully, and what's happened is that in the last 9 months or so, there has been not just a stabilizing, but there's been a little growth in the evening news, in part because people are eager for information during this disquieting time, this time of dislocation. They're looking to know what's going on. Now, there's been a fall off in the last couple of weeks or so in our audience. Over the long haul, the trend has been down. It's still a very powerful force. Brian Williams, on an average weeknight, will deliver about 9 million viewers. That's a lot of circulation. And even Katie, who is in pretty distant third place, has got twice as many viewers as Bill O'Reilly, as I like to point out from time to time. Well, I'll defend that whole piece of it as well in a moment. I think that the evening news is good to go for the foreseeable future. I don't know how prominent it will be. It's not ever going to be like it once was, where we had an appointment to get home at the end of the day and watch the evening news. That doesn't happen anymore. You have too many ways that you can tune into what is happening during the course of the day, either on one of the cable channels or on your PDA or even on your cell phone now. And so at the end of the day, the evening news is more analytical, more in-depth, fewer stories, so that you have a better understanding of what you've been hearing about all day long. I think that's probably a pretty succinct summary of where we are. All of these models now are in peril at the moment because of the economy. People are not spending the money. And when the car companies go under, that's not only a blow to the communities and car dealers and automobile manufacturers and the workers on the assembly line, but they've been big buyers of advertising for news, both in newspapers and on television. And if we can only lose so many of those, and if we don't have the revenue stream, we can't afford to send people to Iraq or to Baghdad. I'll take 10 seconds and give you a perfect example. I've been on the phone most of the morning with the White House about interviewing President Obama next week when he's going to Cairo, Saudi Arabia, Germany, Buchenwald, with an uncle who helped liberate it, and then from there directly to Paris. The 65th anniversary of D-Day is a week from this Saturday. They've agreed that he'll do an interview with me about World War II and the meaning of it. But the scheduling is very tricky. And so I was on the phone just as I pulled up here with one of our producers in New York. And if we do him in Paris, which it now looks like that's where we'll have to do him, we have to get a satellite truck to Paris, we have to get two camera crews to Paris, and we have to get one camera crew back in Normandy because there's stuff going on there. There's this myth among young people that information is free. None of that is free. I mean, that's very expensive stuff, but that's the only way we can do it. And I've been at this long enough, and I care enough about value and the cost basis. I said to the producer who worked for Nightly News, this shouldn't just be on Nightly News's tab. Let's get the Today Show to help pay for it and cable and the other parts of NBC News, because it's going to be expensive before we get all through, but it's what we should be doing.
But we really have sort of trained people in this country to expect that the flow of information to them will continue and advertisers will pay for it. Now that whole notion is an endangered notion for anyone who creates content, be it cinema or music or journalism. And I thought last night your take on sort of this topic was very interesting. You said something about we need to wake up every morning renewing our commitment to being citizens. I assume in part you mean and helping shape the information environment. So,
well, I think we've been on a binge in our economy in a lot of ways, but we've also been on another binge, if you will, about pretending that what happens in the world doesn't count. It does count, and you need to know about it. And the way you find out about what's going on in your community or your state or your nation or the world is through daily journalism. I mean, even the people who rail against journalism and say it's outrageous, then they'll cite some example to me, and I say, where did you read that? Well, I read it in the paper, you know, or I heard it on radio or on television.
Or they saw it online, and it came from the paper.
Yeah, that's right. And so I feel strongly that in this time of reset, and that's what we're going through right now, this is not just a passage, we're reorganizing this country in every conceivable way. We all have to think individually about the place of journalism and about our role as users of journalism. I've said to a large group recently, started to complain about cable and the squeaky wheels getting all the attention. And I said, you need to look at journalism the same way that you look at balancing your check account or buying a house or going to the grocery store. You have to vet what you're getting and be a more engaged consumer of all of that and take a more proactive stance. You can't be just a benign presence. You have to get up in the morning as a citizen and say, what do I need to know today? And where do I find it? And who can I rely on? And when I get that information, how am I going to use it to not just advance my own interests, but the interests of my community?
But I think young people, many of them don't need to be told they need to get up and think about what to do about media. They're engaged with media, and they not only want to be more thoughtful consumers of media, they want to be participants. And in some ways, they are reshaping the world of journalism in very positive ways. And I'm not as sure, I wouldn't have been as sure as you are that we know that people are less interested in what's going on around them. I wouldn't equate viewership and listenership and readership of existing journalism organizations with that. But perhaps you mean
here's my issue with that, Geneva. I judge journalistic competitions. You're familiar with both of them, I think, probably. One is the Livingston Awards. They're for 35 and under journalists. These are the Pulitzers for young journalists. And the other one is the John Chancellor Award at Columbia, which they give $25,000 to two journalists who are the foot soldiers in journalism. So I look at all this body of great work, and it's great work that we see. It's two and three parts. A perfect example is a Phoenix alternative newspaper did a three-part series, I think it was three, it may have been four, on physicians who are abusers of drugs or addicts of one kind or another and how they beat the system, how they stay as practicing physicians. And the people in the greater Arizona area are unaware of how much they're protected and how much they can beat the system. It was four parts. My challenge to an 18-year-old is, who's going to read the four parts? They are tuned in to media, but their attention span is about that long.
I think that's too simple, but I'm not the interviewee. I don't think that's right. They consume information differently, but they can spend plenty of time consuming it. And that four-point series wasn't always worth the entire four parts. I mean, I really do think we need to remember that there are different ways.
I agree with that. I think that sometimes that we, you know, we go along when we don't need to. And that I think, for example, the L.A. Times, and I'm not going to tell them how to run their business, I don't know how many reporters they got on the staff, but as I look at the paper, I look at a lot of stuff that they're still putting in print every day saying, I don't think we need to have that in print. There's a lot of other places that I'm going to get that all day long.
Right.
And why are they making the investment in that? Wouldn't it be better to reduce your staff and have a kind of SWAT team of investigative reporters who are out there doing stuff digitally and online?
Figuring out what they
I do think young people, by the way, and this is where we'll probably find a common intersection, I think this time in their lives is making them stop and looking, I better find out some more information about what's going on, because I've got tough choices, and it's not just, I'm not just on the come line. A very good example of that is that Teach for America, the program for developing teachers in a new and far more imaginative and engaging fashion, is overwhelmed by applicants because they can't go to Wall Street anymore. You know, they can't go to a lot of places that they might have gone before, so they want to go teach because they have to find a job.
And they want to know what information is reliable,
right,
which, of
yeah.
course, is a common ground. Well, you're doing a new project on Route 50, something about. So tell us what stories you think you're likely to encounter that we in the media aren't covering.
I believe for a long time as a member of the, I think probably a gold-plated member of the journalistic establishment. I worked in Washington as a White House correspondent and was on the Today Show and Nightly News. But I've always believed that too much of the dialogue and the setting of the agenda in journalism is on too small an axis between Washington and New York. Right. And during a time of crisis, and we're in a crisis now, there's so much wisdom across the country that we don't hear enough about. And so I believe strongly, even when I was White House correspondent, I would go out into the country from time to time to take a look back at Washington through the eyes of other citizens. We're going from the eastern shore of Maryland all the way to Sacramento, episodically across U.S. Highway 50, which meanders through almost all the political constituencies in the country. It goes through Virginia and West Virginia and Ohio and Illinois and Missouri and Kansas and Colorado and Utah and Nevada. So we touch a lot of bases. We launched it last night, the first one. I started on the Eastern Shore. And what we did last night was a story about, I don't know how many of you are really familiar with the Chesapeake Bay. It's one of the great bodies of water in the world, but it's imperiled at the moment. And it is the source of blue crab, which is a great delicacy. And for more than 140 years, there have been factories on the Eastern Shore that buy the blue crab, and then they have pickers that pick out the meat, and they put it in cans, and they sell it to restaurants and to all of you at Whole Foods or wherever you want to buy it. They can't get workers, even in this economy. They can't get workers in part because they had an arrangement under the immigration laws where they could get temporary visas for Mexican and South American workers who would come up and do the tedious work. Locals just don't want to go there anymore. It is hard duty. There's no question about it. But then there was this crackdown among people who said, we're not going to let foreign workers come into America. They're taking jobs away from Americans. And the owners of this factory said to me, they're going to take all the jobs away from the locals because we're going to have to shut down if we can't get migrant workers coming in here. You know, we've got a system that's been in place for 15 years now. They come back on a regular cycle. They go home for the most part. And now we've been shut down. So that was a consequence of the political impact of anti-immigration. You know, it was not a sensible solution. Then I spent time with two watermen who were out on the bay, and they have been doing this for 50 years, collecting the crabs and the fish and the other things. It's hard work. None of their children will go there. So that way of life is probably coming to an end, and then how do they replace that? In Washington, the next profile is there's a remarkable Korean-American woman in Washington, D.C., by the name of Michelle Wee, who's a new school chancellor, and she is
dynamite.
She is going to change American education the way that she's going about it. She is a phenomenal educator and a real force. There have been other stories about her, but she's worth going back and revisiting again. So what I'm doing in shorthand is going out into America and saying to the rest of the country, here are some things that you need to know about. And some of them are solutions, and they may give you some ideas. And we're already hearing from a lot of people saying, hey, you ought to come to my town. We've figured out how to share jobs, for example.
Are you along Route 50, do you say?
Yeah, right. They have to be in Route 50.
Well, I have one more question, and then I want to turn to all of you who I know have questions. You mentioned Bill O'Reilly. I want to go back to the topic of how many people, although not the majority, I think, but do seem to want news or information that comes from a certain viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Does that worry you? Is that something that we're going
to
see?
No, it really does, and I think that's always been true. I mean, listen, you and I have a kind of shared history in journalism. You'll remember that when we were much younger, that the tabloids all had their own audiences, and there were a lot more of them in the streets of New York at the time, and they all played to a different segment of the audience. The New York Post in those days was a liberal newspaper. The Daily News was a conservative, working-class, blue-collar newspaper.
Chicago.
When I first moved to Los Angeles, the L.A. Times was a big, very conservative newspaper, that had a real iron grip on politics in Southern California. Again, it goes back to, as citizens and as consumers of news, you have to get more proactive. I actually like what I call the Tom Paine environment, having all these voices out there. And the bloggers, a lot of them are interesting and wise, and they've got insights. They're not necessarily journalists, and we ought not to think of them as that.
Some aren't.
Yeah. But a lot of them are commentators, and that's useful for society to have that interchange that is going on. Fox News filled a corner of America that had not been filled for a long time. You know, when I lived in California in the 1960s and was a reporter, there was a left-of-center kind of tyranny in the media, that if you were a conservative voice, it was very hard to get on the air. We had Bill Buckley and George Will, and that was it. There were no other conservative voices that were going at that time. The culture was very strongly in favor of a kind of left-of-center point of view. So I think it's better for democracy to have a wide range of opinions that are available to people, and they can decide what they want to watch and what they don't want to watch. At MSNBC, we have a much more liberal point of view at nighttime, obviously, than they do on Fox with Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews, and that's fine. People know we don't hide this. It's part of the zeitgeist of what MSNBC is in the primetime.
Is it stated anywhere? That always seems to me to be the key, transparency. This particular news medium comes from this standpoint. This one seeks to be as fair and balanced and, you know, objective. And it seems to me that truth in labeling is essential and that we don't always see it. Is there anything on MSNBC that sort of, beside the fact that you're going to see Rachel Maddow, and that tips you off or that straightforwardly informs you that this is going to come from more of a...
Well, first of all, they're commentators. They're not doing the news. They're doing opinion programs, and it's self-evidence. It's not that they're doing the news as they do the news between 9 in the morning and 5 at night when Chris comes on. Those are our local news, the people who bring you the news as the anchors on MSNBC. Then when Chris comes on, he plainly is there as a commentator, interviewer with a strong point of view. Same thing with Keith. Certainly, I think Roger Ailes is a genius at marketing and what he's done, fair and balanced, you know.
I don't think truth in labeling is the strength of any of this.
Well, it's all the news that's fit to print. That's not truth in labeling either.
It's true.
I mean, it goes on across the board. There's marketing everywhere. But again, it comes back, we're not just inanimate objects out there. We have to bring our own intelligence to this when we look at it and decide what's worthy, what holds the test of time, and what doesn't. And the meaning of a First Amendment is everybody has a voice in this country.
Well, you're not just inanimate objects either, and everybody has a voice in this country. So we're going to turn to the audience for your questions. Remember that you need to have a microphone, and why don't we start back here with a hand near that microphone. Great. Thank you, Justin.
Tom, my first job was assistant to Geraldo Rivera at Eyewitness News in 1972. I learned how to be a journalist every day by watching how not to be a journalist. My heart is so broken over the state of journalism in this country and the collapsing newspapers all around and what passes for news on television. The only thing I can say to you is I hope you live to be 125 years old, and I hope you do not ever retire.
Well, retirement was always the wrong word. I was always going to shift into a lower gear, and I seem to have missed that gear somehow and shifted into a higher gear. Geraldo's a perfect example of what happened. He actually did some very good work in the early stages of his career, and then he became all Geraldo all the time, and that's what happened, I think.
There's another one right back here, and then we'll move up to the left front.
I was wondering what you thought about the recent flap with Tom Friedman over having to return the $75,000 speaking fee he got because it violated the New York Times policy of only accepting speaking engagements from nonprofit organizations and educational institutions. And do you think that journalists should make available the speaking fees they're getting so that we know, if there are any conflict of interest?
I think that's tricky. I think the Times policy is pretty good, and I think Tom honestly didn't know. I mean, I'm close to him personally, so I'm inclined to defend him. I haven't talked to him about this particular case. I think he honestly didn't know that that was a I think state-related agency, wasn't it? And so he turned the money right back, and he said, they got a free speech, and I got a free lesson on how to be more careful about what I'm going to do in the future. It's a tricky piece. When I do some speaking to groups. I do more now that I've left Nightly News than I did in the past. I give my money to charity. The people at NBC, there's an ethics officer who passes on what I can do. I don't do groups generally that do lobbying of some kind, and I don't promote products, but I go there and talk to them about the things that we're talking about here today because I see it as an opportunity to reach a wider universe, and then I take the money and send it off to the Committee to Protect Journalists or other organizations of that kind. It's a tricky piece. And I'm not going to suggest to my fellow journalists about what they ought to do, but I think the Times policy is pretty good. I know ours has to, you have to go through an ethics officer, and there's a, the rules are generally, if they're involved in any public fashion in lobbying or anything, you can't go there.
I was just talking to Jim Rainey this morning, and I think we may be hearing more from him on that, actually. I wouldn't be surprised at the L.A. Times.
On the what?
On the whole question, not only of Tom Friedman's speech, but the New York Times policy, and sort of, as you say, it's very tricky.
Yeah, it is very tricky.
Media are often have fairly good policies, but they're not as well followed as they ought to be.
As policed as they are.
Yeah. Yes, right here.
Well, to paraphrase Eisenhower, crisis is an opportunity to begin again more intelligently. So my question to you would be, in relation to our priorities, what would you think is the most important opportunity we have in America right now and the world in terms of changing the past with this crisis?
The rest of you could all hear that about it. Rahm Emanuel has said a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. I've been quoting my boss as well, Jeff Immelt, not just because he's my boss. He said it's not a cycle, it's a reset. I ran into another man who said, if you're not living on the edge, you're taking up too much room. I kind of like that line as well. I suppose if I were to give you a couple of broad headings, one would be we have to engage in a dialogue in this country about values. One of my dearest friends is Yvon Chouinard, who owns Patagonia, the outdoor gear company. He began as a climber. He lives a kind of a Buddhist life. He's a very successful businessman.
It started here, right?
Pardon me?
Did it start here?
It was in Ventura.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said we ought to get up every morning and not ask, what do I want today? What do I need today? And that's a kind of good mantra to have a dialogue about what counts and what is the reflection of the best interest of all of us in society. And, you know, there'll still be people who make a ton of money and spend it on all the toys in the world. But I would hope that we would look more carefully, for example, at housing and what kind of houses we build. You know, in the East, if you go up and down the eastern seaboard, you see this, in the last 15 years, there's been this explosion of McMansions, huge, energy-inefficient homes on tiny lots. Why not have a dialogue about more common wall housing with more green space as part of this reset that we're going through? The market is forcing us to look at automobiles in a much different way and what we buy and how efficient they are. You know, I've got to tell you, California should be a laboratory for the reset. I mean, you've got all the issues that come to play here, and it makes me a little bit crazy. I hear a lot about, you know, we've got to do more about public transportation. I get off the airplane, and they're adding another lane to the 405, and I say, I don't think that makes a lot of sense, frankly, you know.
You got to admit, we're living on the edge, though. Right. There's one back here.
Earlier, you mentioned your concern about young people and believing that information is for free. Could you comment on that a little further and add to it the fact that I think they believe anything that can be put in ones and zeros, any intellectual property, music, movies, books, news, all of it, how do we change that?
We stood around generationally what could only be described as a benign arrogance about what they were saying when they were saying it, about information is free, and music is free, and intellectual property is free because you have access to it. And we should have had a far more aggressive attitude about that. With the benefit of hindsight, I've said that when this new technology first emerged, and I was very keenly aware of the importance and the reach of it, and I went out to know Bill Gates, and we got involved at NBC with Microsoft to do MSNBC, but we didn't go far enough. We needed to be much more aggressive about the pricing model of it so that we could have, in the early stages, with this astonishing technology that is available to us, for nominal sums, made it monetized it in a way that everybody could have afforded, and we could have continued the practices that have come with buying newspapers or magazines or buying books at probably on a scale at a reduced number. But we allow the myth that information is free to get out there, and getting that back in the bottle is really tough. I have a daughter in the music business, and you know what's going on there with the downloading that goes on. I don't care how many times you monitor a college campus, there's always a hacker who knows a way around it and knows how to get at it. There's a lot of talk these days about the online newspapers, the Daily Beast that Tina Brown does, and especially the Huff Post, the Huffington Post that Ariana does. Those are aggregators. They couldn't exist without newspapers and news magazines and the big institutions that are carrying the financial load for all of this. And if we go away, what are they going to do? Because their economic model doesn't work without us, without them riding on our backs. So we have to start talking to young people about why it's important to have access to information and how they may have to pay it for it in some fashion. Doesn't mean that it's going to be onerous, but the big piece that I've been emphasizing recently is the importance of the culture of journalism, that we have to remind people that journalism is a necessary component of our lives, and to move forward during this time, we have to know more, not less, and that we have to encourage better journalism, not more histrionic journalism.
Two or three more questions. Let's go right down over here to the gentleman with the checked shirt. Sort of checked?
Almost
checked.
What do you see as the future of the United Nations?
Of the
United Nations.
Oh, I don't think it's going to go away. It certainly needs reforms. You know, you see the evidence of that every day. What impresses me about the United Nations is not the big political universe that exists in New York, but I really am, as someone who travels the underdeveloped world, part of the world, and the not just the third world, but the fourth and fifth world, I'm impressed with the work of the agencies that the UN has out there, the work that they do in medical care and relief, that kind of thing. I've not given up on the hope that there can be a body in which we can come together and find resolution to some of these issues, but what I've learned as a journalist over the years is that what will never go away in my lifetime or yours or anyone in this room is what I describe as tribal loyalty. And you can describe tribal loyalty in a thousand different ways. It's nationalism, it's states, it's nations, it's whatever. And when they get into a body like that, they revert to tribal loyalty or to nationalism or to state interest. And they always lead with that. And when the United Nations began, coming out of World War II, I think a lot of people believed it would be a new world in which we could find ways to have the common interests of the precious planet represented in a body like that. So it's, I think it'll be there for a long time. It'll be very, very uneven in its application around the world.
Any questions up there? Yes, a woman right in the back row, I think, in orange.
Good afternoon. I'd just like to say that I remember when you first came to Los Angeles and you were so bright and cheerful, and it was fantastic. I sort of was like that myself once. But what I'd really like to ask you is, what can we look for from you in the future? I mean, you've done so many incredible things and have meant so much to all of us.
What has meant the most to me?
What can we look for from you in the future? You've done so many incredible things. What's next?
Well, I'm going to go to the old Anchorman's rest home, and I'm going to get a lap robe and a drool cup. I'm at an interesting stage in my life. I'm 69 years old. I find that astonishing. All my friends tell me I'm going to find 70 a lot more astonishing. And I don't care how many times they say, well, you know, 70 is the new 60. I don't care if it still says 70 on your driver's license. I'm trying to work out what I describe as a checkerboard in life, where I go do the things that I love to do, which are pretty active, and then I come back and I work for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and then I go off and do the things that I love to do for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. This year has been a pretty good model. I went biking in South Africa. And then I came back and worked, and then I went fishing in the Bahamas. I'm a saltwater fly fisherman and did something for ESPN with a group of my pals, came back and went to work. Monday I leave for France on the 65th anniversary of D-Day. I'll have a very active week, and then on Saturday when the D-Day ceremonies are over, I go down to the south of France with a group of friends and go biking for another 5 days. Come back, do some more work, and then I've got a pretty active summer planned. I'll never give up the opportunities that come my way, and I love being a journalist. I am insatiably curious about how the world works and how we can make it better, and I look at my grandchildren, which I have four now, and I wonder what kind of a world they're going to have, and I try to engage them in that dialogue with me. And mostly if I have some standing in the world, I want to take advantage of it to have access to the people I think have something to say, and to try to bring to your attention and to others the conditions that exist in the world. I just wrote a blurb today for Nick Kristof, who is a columnist for the New York Times, and his wife, Cheryl Woudon, have done a book called Half the Sky. And it is a book about the condition of women in the world. And it is a really powerful piece of journalism, very passionately executed. And once you leave these shores, the kind of outrageous treatment of women economically and culturally and physically around the world is a scandal for our time. So there's always a story to report on. There's always something to bring to the attention of others. And I admire people like Nick and Cheryl for the work that they're doing. And you know, as long as I keep my hand in it, I'll do it for a while. Doesn't mean I'm going to get on every overnight flight there is to some hellhole in the world, but I'll, as long as I can still keep my legs, I'll stay active.
Better for the south of France. Right. One question down here. And this will be our last, I believe.
Good afternoon, Tom. I heard on NPR either last night or this morning a quote from Winston Churchill who said, "Americans will always do the right thing once they've exhausted every other option." In your investigative and journalistic work, do you recall a favorite story that you did that an American did the right thing as a direct result of something that you reported?
You know, I think probably when I do go to the old Anchorman's Rest Home and they write about that, I think maybe my greatest journalistic legacy, I would like to, if I could write my own, it would be that he got it right or he tried to get it right all the time. But the single biggest contribution that I may have made is writing The Greatest Generation and bringing to the attention of the rest of us how much they went through, how much we owe them. People often say, "I don't know, that seems like you, The Greatest Generation going a little too far." I say, "That's my story and I'm sticking to it." But a perfect example, on the flight on the way out here, two attendants gave me letters that they hand wrote up in the forward part of the cabin when they realized I was on the flight about how my book changed their relationship with their fathers, how they had not understood what their dads had gone through until they read that book, and how grateful they were that they were able to go back to their dad with a new understanding of what life had been like for him and why he was so tough in some ways and why he saw the life through a different prism than they did. That happens to me two or three times a week, sometimes every day. And it will continue to be a reaffirming experience for me and a renewing experience for me. It's something I did not anticipate. I thought I was writing the book for that generation. And I was writing for myself, obviously. But it's been out for 10 years. It still comes up on a regular basis.
How did you know that that story needed to be told in book form as opposed to television?
Well, I knew about the permanence of print, for one thing. I'd been wanting to write a book. I was working on something else at the time, and this had been piling up in me. It started on the 40th anniversary of D-Day when I walked onto the beaches with, as I later described it, two members of the Big Red One. They were 18 and 19 years old when they landed that day, and they were there with their wives, and they looked exactly like everybody I had grown up with, as my friends of my parents and the teachers in town and the shopkeepers and so on. Their wives were off to the side, and they had their bandanas pulled over their new permanents that they'd had done just that morning, and they were carrying their handbags, and the guys had their American Legion windbreakers on, tiny men. One of the things that people forget about is that these guys all came out of the Depression. And I was with one of them yesterday, and he said, I'd never had a real breakfast until I went in the Army. We just didn't have, you know, we had fried cornmeal for dinner. And he said, we got in the Army, we had real breakfast. And I had my first new pair of boots when I went in the Army. Never had a new pair of boots before. So these two little men out on the beach started telling him what it was like that day. One of them earned the Medal of Honor later, and the other one lost both legs. And I went staggering back to the small cafe, and I was sitting there, and a man by the name of Sam Gibbons, who was a Florida congressman, big raw bone guy that was on the House Ways and Means Committee, came over to the table and said, Tom, Sam Gibbons. And I said, I know who you are, Congressman. Why are you here? And he said, well, I was here 40 years ago. And he pulled out the little cricket that the 82nd Airborne used to connect with each other. And he clicked it. And I said, what happened to you? And he started telling this story. And it was so unsettling, a story about how he got separated from his outfit, put together a little squad, fought for the next 36 hours every minute, trying to stay alive. Big, tough guy. Tears streaming down his face as he told the story. The entire cafe went dead silent. And his wife touched him a couple of times and said, Sam, you don't have to do this. He said, I do. I have to tell the story. So, you know, that's at the end of the first day. And now I start going back and collecting more and more of these stories. And I use the themes in the commencement speeches. And the first time I used the phrase, the greatest generation, was on the air at the 50th anniversary. And Stephen Ambrose, my friend, came over to me and said, I hope that's going to be a book. And I had been kind of thinking about it at that time. And so then I wrote the book, and it took off in a way that I never could have anticipated. So when I go to Normandy now, it's almost an out-of-body experience. They have all these banners along the coastline in Couville-sur-Mer and at Saint-Mère-Église and Bayeux that say, welcome back to the greatest generation. And I said to a couple of my friends, they said, that must make you very proud. And I said, well, it does, but I really was a doorman. I mean that. I opened the door. I opened the door and said, this way, please. Here are some stories that you should know about. And that's how I continue to feel.
Well, how appropriate that we should end with a book. I want to thank this great library for hosting this wonderful conversation. And please join me in thanking the remarkable Tom Brokaw.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.